Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking of the exhibition called History of the Future, La Historia del Futuro. Right now, I'd like to welcome Revel Carr. He is the author of the new book, Seeds of Discontent, The Deep Roots of the American Revolution, 1650 to 1750. And he will be speaking tomorrow evening, Friday, November 14th, at 6 in the evening at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
So what is the regular textbook narrative that we learn in school about the seeds of the American Revolution?
Well, what we learn in school, we may not retain, and what most of us retain is that Columbus sailed the ocean blue, the Pilgrims landed on Plymouth Rock, and then there was a revolution. We don't really retain, most of us don't retain, what happened in those really critical years as the colonies developed, and then as the colonies were dragged into European wars on several occasions, which created havoc for the people who were living in the colonies, and in the midst of that, planted seeds of discontent, influenced their thoughts about their relationship with the mother country.
Well, there was something about stamps and tea.
Yes, and that is where the real causes of the revolution lie. In that time from the end of the French and Indian War in 1763 and to Concord and so on in 1775. And so the causes lie there, but I contend that there were these events that planted seeds of discontent going back more than 100 years that prepared people for revolution. And Samuel Adams was, when he reflected on the war, wrote, "What do we mean by the revolution? The war? That was no part of the revolution. It was only an effect and consequence of it. The revolution was in the minds of the people." And that's my point with this book. I'm trying to take a fresh look at our colonial history and look at what affected the minds of the people. And I believe that there were a series of events which planted these seeds of discontent.
So when you go back to the middle of the 17th century, what was the process of English colonization like? Who was coming to the New World and for what reasons?
Well, there were a lot of dissidents coming, and for that reason, England was happy to have established the colonies. The New World had been colonized for some time by the Spanish to the south, and to a smaller degree by the French to the north, and England needed colonies, and there were these dissidents, religious dissidents in many instances, and people who had been forced off their land, who were leading really grim lives in England, they were brave enough to think, all right, if I take the risk and go across the ocean and face the wilderness, I may have a better life for myself, for my family, I may also have religious freedom. And one of the curious elements in both the 17th and 18th century is that there is an identical pattern of a period of neglect. In the 17th century, it was benign neglect because the English had lots of other stuff going on, and we might come back to that. Then there was a time when they clamped down on the colonies and started to exploit the colonies, and then the colonies rebelled and rose in revolt. And that happened not only in the 18th century that we all know about, but it happened in the 17th century as well. There was a full-blown revolution. There were some minor revolts, but there was a full-blown revolution in this country in 1689. And it's something that, again, few of us even know about, and yet it ricocheted all the way down the coast from Maine to Pennsylvania, and there were, as I say, some other revolts farther south.
What was the so-called revolution of 1689 about? What happened? What were the reasons for it? Who was revolting?
Sure. The causes, as I say, there was a period of neglect while England wrestled with its problems between Parliament and the kings in the early part of the 17th century.
So basically it said, you people want to go, just go.
Go, exactly.
Have fun. And we're not going to pay attention to you.
And set things up on your own and so on. So they actually in that time acquired a sense of self-governance, self-reliance, and later, when England clamped down, they didn't like that. So things were so strained in England that they chopped off the king's head, and they had a period of time with no king, the period of the interregnum. And then following that, they brought back the king, or the son of the king whose head was chopped off, and that was Charles II, and he was later succeeded by James II. And those two needed money, and they realized that the colonies by that time were a source of funds. And so they began to clamp down, and when the colonies didn't quite rebel at that point, but when the colonies resisted that clamping down, they decided, we'll solve this problem. We'll combine them all into, or all the northern ones, into one giant colony. So Maine, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New York, East Jersey, West Jersey, were all combined into one giant colony called the Dominion of New England, with one very heavy-handed guy in charge, a man named Edmund Andros.
And was he governing from England across a large distance, or was he located in New England?
He was located in New England. His mentor had been James the Duke of York, who had been given New York after it had been captured by the Dutch by his brother. And then James succeeded his brother as the King of England, so he was James II. And he knew that Andros, who he had had governing New York, was a tough cookie and would really enforce the rules. And so he combined all the colonies and put Andros in charge of them all. Andros governed from Boston and had another deputy governor in New York. And it was in that mode that the colonists felt they could not tolerate this oppression, and they rose up in revolt.
And so this was the 1689.
1689, exactly. And we have to comment, though, that there was something else going on at the time in England, which was they were upset with James II, a Catholic king and with a Catholic son, and they didn't want another Catholic ruler. So in England, they invited William and Mary, William of Orange, a staunch Protestant, and his wife Mary, who was actually the daughter of James II, over from Holland to wrest the Catholic throne away from James II and make it a Protestant throne. The people in New England did not know whether that had happened or whether that had succeeded when they took the risk of their lives, to rise in revolt against Andros, who was James II's man in New England.
So how did it come out?
It came out well. On the one hand, they were successful. It turned out to be bloodless. They were gun barrel to gun barrel, and thousands could have been killed. It was that kind of a tense situation, but they did capture Andros and the others who worked with him. They imprisoned him for 9 months, and by that time they learned that William and Mary had in fact succeeded in England. And then they packed off Andros back to England with 32 charges against him, and of course, in part of a pattern that would plant these seeds of discontent, the colonies were given short shrift. Andros was acquitted of all the charges, and in fact, he was made governor of Virginia as a compliment to him. So right from the beginning, the colonies were rejected. The complaints of the colonies were rejected.
Another factor is the whole economic productivity of the New World. When people first got here from England, they were starving and barely able to survive the terrible winters. But at a certain point, they started producing wealth, and then England wanted it, they wanted to tax it, and they didn't want to give anything back in return. What was that whole dynamic like?
Well, again, it was that clamping down. The colonies had enjoyed a period of freedom in their shipping and in what they did with the products that they did produce.
What were they producing?
They were producing all kinds of wooden elements. The wood in this country was a great asset. They were producing textile fibers as well, and ultimately tobacco, which became a huge product in the Middle American colonies, and the English became quickly addicted to tobacco, and it became a major element in this.
Wow, and they weren't even addicted before that.
No,
right.
It wasn't there.
Right.
Tobacco came from the New World, and so. And so it was that kind of environment where the colonies could do what they wanted when England started to apply what were called navigation acts and restricted who they could ship their cargoes in, which meant they couldn't use, for example, a Dutch ship if it was less expensive. They had to use an English ship to ship their cargoes. And cargoes coming to the colonies had to pass through England and be taxed, and therefore were more expensive in the colonies than had they come straight from France or somewhere directly to the colonies. So in a number of ways, this impeded the growth of the colonies, and they rebelled against it.
I suppose these conversations about free trade go back centuries.
They absolutely do.
There's another factor also, which is that it's not only England that was colonizing this continent. It was also France and Spain and Holland, and the people in the New World were becoming pawns of the conflicts among those various European countries.
That happened immediately after that revolution of 1689, because the colonies thought, all right, we've overthrown the Andros and so on, and William and Mary will look with benevolence upon us. That didn't bring back the original charters that they wanted, but what did happen was they were immediately drawn into the first of several European wars, known as King William's War here, the War of the Grand Alliance in Europe, and the colonies didn't want to be in this battle, but they were drawn into it, and it turned out that particular war lasted for 9 years and proved absolutely nothing. Everybody was suffering from loss of resources, terror. The French and Indians were really practicing nationally authorized terror campaigns along the northern coast or northern area of settlement in New England, and it was pure terror for 9 years with nothing to prove for it. The war was ended, and the colonies had spent money, had spent lives, had their lives disrupted, lived in terror with nothing. And the peace that was gained then lasted 3 years. And then another war broke out. It was Queen Anne's War, in the exact same kind of situation.
One forgets, or maybe never knew, how violent the colonial period was.
Yeah, it was as I say, for those on the frontier, it was a life of terror, and the stalwart colonists really deserve the credit that they should be given for that. They took their lives in their hands every time they went out into their farm fields. The second war, this Queen Anne's War that I mentioned, for the first year after it was declared, New France, Canada, and New England managed to stay at peace. They managed not to be drawn into the war. But after a year, they were drawn in, and it started with a coordinated raid on August 10th of 1703, all along the main frontier border. And community after community after community was attacked by the French and Indians, and the people were either slaughtered or carried off as prisoners to the north. And then the following year, there was a very famous attack on Deerfield in Massachusetts, in which not only were 40 or more of the residents of Deerfield killed in the attack, but 111 of them were marched north through the snow to remain as captives in either of the Indians or of the French in Canada for years, and it took years to ransom them back.
When England was trying to control the colonies, and the colonies didn't want to be controlled because they'd fostered this spirit of independence, did England provide carrots as well as sticks?
Seldom. It really was a matter of forcing the colonies into obedience to the crown, and there was a period of about 25 years of peace that happened after 1713, but then two wars, the War of Jenkins' Ear, which is my favorite named war, and I won't go into how it got named after Mr. Jenkins' Ear, but in that war, for the first time, the term American was used to apply to the people who lived here, and an American regiment was formed that was taken to the Caribbean to fight on behalf of the English. The Americans were a ragtag-looking group. They didn't have uniforms, etc., and they were ridiculed and abused by the British officers who were in charge of that effort. The whole event turned into a total debacle. The main target was Cartagena in Colombia, and it was such a disaster that 9 out of 10 of the people from Massachusetts and Rhode Island, for example, that went in that campaign died. Imagine, and this was a war of choice, something that we know about these days, a war of choice in which of the Americans who went, from the Northeast anyway, 9 out of 10, and from all the Americans, over 2/3 died. Imagine a war today when 9 out of 10 of the people you sent didn't come home. A seed of discontent, to be sure. And that was followed by the major event, and a lot of the book looks at this event. There was a major fortress called Louisbourg on Cape Breton Island, and the French had built this during that 25 years of peace because they anticipated another war, and they needed a place to launch attacks against the New Englanders. Well, the New Englanders, the French did, in fact, launch attacks against the New Englanders, and the New Englanders said, we can capture that. No one gave them a chance. This was a heavily fortified city. Benjamin Franklin, whose brother was in the campaign, said fortified cities are tough nuts to crack. No one thought they could do it. And yet, in 50 days, they raised an army of over 3,000 men, a flotilla of over 100 ships and 14 colonial warships to go and lay siege. A British squadron did come up and helped blockade, but they didn't fire a single shot in the attempt to take the city. And the Americans did. However, then the English admiral or commodore stepped in and said to the French, you don't want to surrender to this rabble out there. They'll rape and pillage. You ought to surrender to the civilized English. And he took the surrender when it belonged to the New Englanders, who had made all the financial and life sacrifices. And then, following on that, they hoisted the French flag over the fortress again. Rich French ships from Peru, loaded with silver and gold, came in and were captured because they thought, with the French flag flying, that it was still a French city. They were captured by the Royal Navy, who took all the money. So that the American soldiers who made all the sacrifices got nothing. One soldier got 6 fine-toothed combs as his reward, and the British Commodore got the equivalent of over $20 million in today's money. From the prize money from these ships. So the British sailors who did nothing got rich, the Americans who made all the sacrifices lost, and ultimately, 2 years later, the British gave that city back to the French. And there are today 1,200 American soldiers buried in shallow graves outside Louisbourg whose white bleached bones still poke through the soil today.
Oh my goodness.
And they are the ones who made the sacrifice, and England took all the credit, all the resources, and then gave it back to the French.
So that has the effect of making people mad.
It planted significant seeds of discontent. And an interesting young person arrived on the scene just as that was happening, and that was Samuel Adams, whose beer we know so well these days. But Samuel Adams was fresh out of Harvard University with a master's degree, and he started a newspaper called the Independent Advertiser, and it was only in existence for 3 years. But in that newspaper, they really took the English to task, and he wrote a magnificent essay that took the whole front page and major part of the inside, and he laundry listed all these seeds of discontent and essentially called for revolution. He said, what's to keep the English from giving us, the New England colonies, away in exchange for another peace? If they'll give our conquest away, why wouldn't they, in another war, give away Massachusetts and Maine, whatever, to the French? And so he said, if that happens, we may have to rise up and defend our country. And he referred to it as our country. So he was seeing not these as English colonies, but seeing it as a country. And he made an eloquent plea.
And there was also a philosophical underpinning of the rights of man, which was relatively new.
Absolutely. And he had built that into his master's thesis from Harvard University. And certainly that was in there, that if the government does not function on behalf of the people, then the people have the right and the obligation, in fact, to rise up against the government.
And that starts sounding like familiar language. Revel
there
Carr.
There are lessons of history.
Revel Carr is the author of Seeds of Discontent, The Deep Roots of the American Revolution, 1650 to 1750. And he will be speaking tomorrow evening, Friday, the 14th of November at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking about the history of the future. Please stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome Nancy Suter. She is the curator of the exhibition History of the Future, La Historia del Futuro, which is opening this Saturday, November 15th, and runs through the 31st of December at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, thank you.
So, history of the future, that sounds like an oxymoron.
That is a quote from Charles Bowden.
Whom we'll be talking to in a few minutes.
He's the writer that's involved in this project, along with Julian Cardona, photographer, and Michael Berman, also a photographer. The history of the future is a concept that I think has to do with the idea that Juarez is a laboratory for the future, that if things don't change in the world, that what's going on in Juarez, the poverty and desperation, is a template for a much wider arena for that kind of world.
Michael Berman is joining us by telephone, and he is a photographer. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello. How are you doing?
Good. How are you? You just got back from photographing in the desert in both Texas and Mexico on the other side of the border. What's the nature of your photography? What kind of projects are you doing?
Right now I'm working on a project photographing the Chihuahuan Desert, which I'm sort of thinking of as a big unknown desert that stretches along the border from the corner of Arizona all the way into West Texas and north into New Mexico and very south into Chihuahua.
What is it that draws you to that particular desert?
It's still a bit wild, and it's a place where one can go to for a couple weeks and actually be alone, and that's something that I enjoy and seek out a lot.
There's, when you say you can be alone there, you're alone in terms of people, but there's this amazing ecosystem around you. What are you actually photographing?
I'm photographing the grasslands, which is the dominant species of the desert, but it's really, what I'm really looking at and thinking about is that there's so few places that actually have a climax ecosystem and where you see a lot of different plants and a lot of things that are intact. And often, especially in Mexico, if you get up into some of the mountains, there really have not been a lot of people or a lot of use in the smaller mountains that are out in the desert because they haven't run water up top, and you'll find places that are like these magical gardens. So it's really pretty wonderful to be able to do it.
Tell us about your contribution and your collaboration in this exhibition, The History of the Future.
The History of the Future is part of earlier work that I've been doing on the border of Sonora and southwest Arizona. And I'd been working out there for photographing for about 7 years, but it's a place that I went to over the last 20 years. And for a long time, I would go there and not photograph. And a few years back, I was working on a project there, and I really began to felt the landscape was in play, that something was changing. And unfortunately, it's turned out to be a bit prescient in that the border has kind of gone a little bit crazy, and a place that really was allowed to be alone is now sort of participating in a madness of two different countries sort of playing their games along the border.
What kind of madness, what kind of changes are you talking about?
Well, it's just the, as we tighten our border up, then it becomes more complicated, more complex, in that what was really simple interactions between people. I mean, there's one thing about the desert is that almost everybody, it's human nature to help somebody in the desert who needs it. And what ends up happening is it's no longer about the people who are there, but it's all of a sudden somebody's paying money in, you know, Central America or the middle of Mexico to go to Chicago, and it's a lot of money. And so rather than moving through the cities, people are trying to cross in these wild open spaces, and it's really rather a difficult crossing.
Michael Berman is part of the exhibition, The History of the Future. Thank you so much for being with us. And we're going to talk to another photographer, Julian Cardona, in just a moment. Nancy Suter, so how did you come up with the idea? In other words, have you personally spent time in the border area?
In the past, I have. I've been in New Mexico for 30 years and lived in southern New Mexico, the beginning of my time here, and actually used to go to Juarez a lot, and the whole area. I've known Michael Berman for many years and have been looking at his work for a long time. About 2 years ago, Michael and I started talking about the trilogy that the University of Texas Press is producing. The first book is Inferno with Bowden and Michael Berman. The second volume in the trilogy, Exodus, is out right now, just hot off the press, and there will be a book signing for both of these books on Saturday.
At the opening, this coming Saturday at the Santa Fe Art Institute.
And there's a third book in the trilogy called Trinity that's due in 2009. And my interest in this exhibit came from the way that Michael's work and Julian's work resonate with each other, and then kind of rounded out with the voice of Charles Bowden, and the idea for an exhibit came up about 2 years ago.
I'd like now to welcome Julian Cardona. He is a photographer based in Ciudad Juarez, who is part of the exhibition History of the Future. Welcome.
Welcome. Many thanks.
Thank you. So, why did you choose Ciudad Juarez and the border as a place to live and photograph? You're, I think, originally from Zacatecas.
Well, my choice was not possible because I was a baby. I was taken here when I was very small child. But I chose to live here anywhere. Anyway,
what?
And I have spent my life here on the border. And at some point, I was working for a newspaper in Mexico, in Juarez, Mexico. And I realized there was something happening here, and we decided to make a project which was called Nada Que Ver, Nothing to See, on the mid-90s, and later became the Juarez Laboratory for Future, the book.
How has the border changed in the time that you've been photographing it? It seems like there's a lot more violence and a lot more sorrow on the border.
Yes, I have been covering the border for 15 years. At first, when we made the first book, people were saying that something like that was not happening on the border. The Juarez book came out in 1998. At that time, it was a hard reality, but only seen by some people, maybe the victims and journalists. And as I said before, few people believed on something like that was happening in the city. But soon later, there were many more homicides and women murders, and the city became internationally famous because of its violence. It's not a very good category to be famous. But it's known widely because of the women murders. But now, recently, this year, the explosion of executions have been like never before. We are reaching the 1,300 mark this year. Last year, we had 300 homicides, 301.
What is the relationship like with the people that you photograph? The photographs that are in this exhibition are amazing, and they're very intimate and sometimes very sad. What is this process of photography like?
Well, for me, it's an exercise in journalism, in this case photojournalism, and I have tried to follow the link between a city immersed on the front lines of globalization, like Juarez, who have been in some way globalized for four decades now. And the first book was about what happens to a city globalized for many years, where the gap between poor and rich is so big, so huge. And, of course, that later happened to the border when the free trade agreement, NAFTA, took effect. And a massive exodus of people started about 5 years after the agreement was signed. That's the link between both books and both bodies of work in my case.
We're talking to Julian Cardona. What do we know about the murders of the women in Juarez? There's, as you say, a tremendous amount of international attention on them, but do we even know what the motivation is for them?
Well, many people were coming with trying to help. They found a very complex city that is hard to understand for many people. It's very complex, and for me, one of the things that led to this massive crime against women, children, and men, it's due to the economic conditions, which are not fair for everybody. Many people can make a lot of money. We have two economies in the city, for example, in what is two globalized economies. The U.S. plants and, of course, drug trafficking. Both are globalized and both are competing in the city, and both are generating a very, very complex social situation unfolding here in the city. And basically, that translates into crime.
Julian Cardona is a photographer whose work is going to be shown in the History of the Future, La Historia del Futuro, which opens this Saturday at the Santa Fe Art Institute here in Santa Fe from 5 to 7 in the evening. Thank you, Julian, for being with us, and we'll see you this Saturday.
Thank you, Marie Charlotte. I hope your audience will visit our show.
Definitely. And we're going to speak to Charles Bowden in just a couple of minutes. But Nancy Suter, so this is part of the Santa Fe Art Institute series called Outsider, Tourism, Migration, and Exile. And, of course, all of those are very much themes that come up when you talk about the border issues. The photography is just incredible. You obviously are the one who made the selections as a curator for this show.
I did. I collaborated with the artists making the selections. That was a long and thorough process and a really wonderful process. And we're installing the show right now. And to have been dealing with the images on my computer screen for many months and getting very, very, very familiar with these images, and now to see the actual prints in their the space that they hold and the energy that they contain is, of course, completely different than seeing them on a computer screen. And the dialogue between the coolness of Michael Berman's work and the heat of Julian's work really creates a dialogue just in their approach and their process.
There is a lot that we hear, and sometimes not even that much, sometimes there are long periods where we hear nothing about issues of immigration and issues of the border, but there are things that we hear in the news, and sometimes the media tend to over-dramatize conflicts because that's what they do, they like to write about conflicts. And there are also many things that we don't know, and sometimes things that can be shown in photographs. What have you yourself learned and absorbed through the process of looking at these photographs?
The incredible courage of the people who leave their homes and families in the desperation of the towns and villages and cities in Mexico that causes people to embark on this extremely dangerous and risky migration. One of the other things that I've seen from this is the beauty and the fragile, the almost terrible beauty and the fragility of the ecosystem of these lands.
I'd like to welcome now, joining us by telephone, the writer Charles Bowden, who is also part of The History of the Future. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be in your cafe.
Thank you. Wish you were here in person. You will be here soon because the exhibition opens this Saturday. When we think about the border, even the word border has a lot of different meanings. Some people think that you can seal a border. And for others like you, border is a concept that almost doesn't exist. I mean, you say that you've been crossing and ignoring borders all of your life. How do you think of the word or concept of the border, especially this particular Mexican-American border?
Well, the Mexican-American border is an arbitrary line drawn between two states after the Mexican War. It's pretty simple. The United States stole half of Mexico and made a line. What you have now, because of the economic collapse in Mexico and Central America, is the largest folk movement on the surface of the earth. And it's not easy. It's almost impossible to stop. I'll give you an example. At the time of the Mexican War, the U.S. Army had 15,000 soldiers. Now we got almost 20,000 people on the line trying to stop a migration.
And as you have made clear in your work, a lot of the Mexican immigrants we have here were encouraged to leave Mexico because they actually make more money in the United States for Mexico than Mexico itself makes selling oil.
Yeah, well, look at the oil. You know, it depends on what it's going for a barrel. But basically, remittances are certainly number two in their source of foreign currency, or number three. Their actually biggest source of foreign currency is drugs, but nobody wants to talk about that. But if these people weren't sending back money back to Mexico, I think the country would collapse. They sent over $20 billion last year. I mean, the people that are mowing lawns, building houses here, and washing dishes and whatnot. It's one of the most extraordinary infusions of money by the poor to the poor in the history of the world.
What is the role of drug trafficking in the sort of militarization or near militarization of the border at this point? I mean, are we, as you know, the United States trying to keep out drug traffickers, or people working in kitchens, or what's really going on?
Well, what we're trying to do, there's two things. I'll make it simple. Both the war on drugs and homeland security are simply acts played for domestic politics in this country. Everybody gets reelected to Congress by saying they want to build a wall. Everybody coming north goes through the wall. Some of your listeners may have actually had a drug in their life they bought on the street. There's no shortage of them, and the price is cheap, and the quality's high. In other words, neither the Border Patrol nor the DEA in the end have any real impact on the movement of drugs or people.
And so, basically, there's this gigantic concentration of men with guns just not having any effectiveness whatsoever.
Well, they have an effect. Like, I've watched in the last 2 years the cost of being smuggled across the border by coyotes gone up a couple thousand dollars. But trust me, both the cocaine and the worker arrive in Chicago on time. But what we created is a giant industry for ourselves. In the drug world, we're spending about $40 billion a year, at least, for narcotics officers in this country. We'll skip the prisons. And good God, the Border Patrol's getting to be a private army all of itself. It'll be 20,000 people next year. And so then it has a life of its own. But what's driving the migration north is need. This isn't even a migration in the sense of somebody coming up for seasonal labor. This is an escape from an imploding economy in Mexico. You might as well try and stop a hurricane.
We're talking to Charles Bowden. You've been writing about this for a long time. What is your own personal interest? What is your passion about this?
My passion is I live on the border. people die. I see a militarization of the border, a standing army. I see thousands of people slaughtered in the drug world. I'm sure you're, I don't know if your listeners know it, but since January 1st, 1,270 human beings have been murdered in Juarez, just one little, one border city.
Right.
And then I buy newspapers, and it's not in there. So one day I drank a cup of coffee, left the door, and decided I'd fix that. Turned out it took me longer than I planned.
What is it like? I mean, one of the things that I've always been struck by is, for example, going from El Paso to Juarez is the incredible contrast between the two sides of the border. Juarez having this incredible teeming life. I mean, it's a, you know, you can call it a dangerous city, and in some parts it is, and so on. And then El Paso being kind of weirdly sterile and quiet and almost depopulated in comparison.
Well, El Paso's got about 800,000 people. Juarez has about 2 million. But the change isn't simply what you might think of tempo. Is that Juarez is a lot poorer. You know instantly that you've crossed into another country. And now with the recession globally, Juarez is shedding jobs. This spring they lost 20,000 factory jobs and God knows how many by now. And so it's a powder keg. El Paso, I think, has had about 10 or 15 murders this year. As I mentioned, Juarez is moving up on 1,300 murders so far this year. That's a pretty big difference.
It's huge. And who is murdering whom and for what reason?
Well, there's various reasons. One, you know, in the end it comes down to drugs, poverty, and money. Of course, you know, that it isn't simply a cartel battle. Most of the people that have been killed are nobodies. But in a city like Juarez, everybody tangentially in the end has some connection to drugs because it's a major industry, that it's a free-for-all. The other thing you have to remember is out of almost 1,300 murders, I think there's only been 15 or 20 arrests. So if you want to kill somebody, go ahead and do it. Nobody's going to pester you about it. That makes a lot of guys a little frisky. The final thing is there's 500 gangs there. And they're all heavily armed after years of being a warehouse district for drugs. So there's a lot of firepower. People get testy, they just blow somebody away.
Tell us about this collaboration that is part of the History of the Future exhibition.
Oh, sure. I'll make it simple. Look, the essence of the border between the United States and Mexico is dry land. That all along the border, the characteristic is dry land, and the essence of desert on this border is the Pinacate in Sonora and the Cabeza Prieta in the United States and Arizona. And that's the core of Inferno, a kind of exploration of the essence. Exodus is a collaboration that was Julian Cardona that we've spent 7-8 years on. We both decided the most significant thing going on, possibly in the world, was this mass migration of the poor from Mexico to the United States. We both thought it was only hardly being recognized except as a police issue. And we both decided we'd create a record. And so we did. That's called Exodus.
Charles Bowden will be here for the exhibition, The History of the Future, La Historia del Futuro, which opens at the Santa Fe Art Institute. And there's much more to talk about, but we will see you then, and you'll also be part of a panel discussion that's happening from 3 to 5 on that day.
Sure, come on down. We'll have us a time.
Indeed. Thank you. And Nancy Suter is still with us. This is an exhibition that has been put together by you, the Santa Fe Art Institute, and the Lannan Foundation.
The Lannan Foundation has been an incredible support and encouragement. The project fits completely with their mission of promoting cultural freedom. And in conjunction with the exhibition, we have produced a book with essays, several essays by Julian, Chuck Bowden, an introduction by myself, an introduction by Christy Mazuera Davis of the Lannan, and another essay by Ezequiel Exgura about the ecology of the desert. with the photographs, several photographs from each of the artists. In addition, we have produced a DVD that will be part of the exhibit, and the exhibition and the whole project is going to travel to several other venues over the next 2 years.
What do you hope that this exhibition can accomplish by being seen by Americans who just don't know that much about the border?
Part of it is awareness, raising awareness about the issues. I think part of it also is bearing witness to what it is that's going on and potentially inspiration for taking action.
Nancy Suter is the curator of The History of the Future, La Historia del Futuro, and it opens once again at the Santa Fe Art Institute in Santa Fe this Saturday at, from 5 to 7 is the reception and book signing, which is free, and also there's a panel discussion with, just the people we've been talking to right now on this show, is that right? Michael
yes.
Berman, Julian Cardona, and Charles Bowden.
In addition to those people, Scott Carrier, who is a radio personality, he produces Hearing Voices, who has worked with all of the other people involved in the project, doing audio recordings and audio and video recordings.
And for more information, people can go to sfai.org or call 424-5050. Nancy Suter, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks so much to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features an interview with two-time Grammy winner Maria Schneider. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Bye.